This recording is brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit us at cbillpodcast.com. Tim Lewis launched his new book, The Virginiad, on October 9, 2008, at a reception in Charlottesville. Ranging from first contact in 1607 to the present day, The Virginiad traces the history of this land as seen through the eyes of ordinary Virginians. Lewis read from his book and took questions from the audience.
Thank you. This is great. This is the first event, real event, for the Virginiad, this new book that I've written. And it marks the start of a tour that I'm going to be doing all around Virginia over the next 3 or 4 months. I'm going to do a reading in every single county and city of the Commonwealth. That's the idea. And so this is the first one, so you guys can say you were in at the beginning. And so the format for tonight is I'm going to read for about 30, 40 minutes. Then we'll have a discussion, okay? Your opinions, questions, anything like that. And then I'll just finish up with a couple more poems at the end, okay? And feel free to help yourself to the buffet if you like. So this, before each poem or each selection, I'm going to tell you what the page number is and what the year is, okay? So this first poem is right at the beginning. It's 1607, and it's page 13. Okay. By 1607, Native Americans had lived in Virginia for at least 11,000 years. This poem begins with a call for the calm earth to awake, welcoming Kashutse, the sun. Upawak is sacred tobacco, and this poem includes several Indian words for sacred implements, practices, and clothes. You'll see a footnotes for these words in the book, but I won't go through them here. And one final thing is that Wind Teller is a horseman figure who observes and guides, is a guide through the whole story. He's like an observer of everything that happens through Virginia history. 'Tis time. 'Tis time to ring the circle of 10,000 years and mark the passing of 400 with an abundance of our mercy tears and harsh truth of our inheritance. So come with me, soft wanderers, and listen to the whispers of those veiled and visioned ancestors who wish to tell their silent tale and give some deeper insight into whom we are today. But hush, hush, hush. For as I stand upon the eastern shore, a dark rise irks us begone, and with a trepidatious glance drop Upawak upon the lurking sun. Oma Uma, Kokwa Ifwe, Aspamu. With open arms towards the dawn, Kenkut Emma Keshotse, Oh, Netapawe. Such is our strength, our power, the power of our many and our one. I hold the strength of this land in my embraced arms. 10,000 times upon Assateague's weeping shore, we have raised our high-stretched arms. Upon Rappahannock, Potomac, upon the rilting Appomattox, upon the confluence of Pamunkey and deep soft Mattapony, upon the Manahoac Forest Hills and the Monasukapano Rills, upon chestnut dales of Monacans, rift-rivered vales of Chutilo, and far-clouded Shawanwa ranges that echo to the eagled rage of the uninterrupted ages. 10,000 times we have raised our sage to that same orb that shines across our peoples, and thanked it for the calm of earth we sit absorb upon. And we beg you listen careful now, great Keshotse and your blood-red shift, to that forgotten heritage we will lose so tenderly, so silently. To the drifts the past will spell, preserved despite our cave-dwell fall, lessons of a common caste as humans, within all that is past, that is all. So hush, my ravened babe, Lie soft and take your time, for the journey is bare bemoaned, and there lurks a sultry lisping gloam upon this linger-fingered land of wind-green waving growth and aroma of lush decay. As a storm of start-sparked pigeons darkens the dawn-lit scray of ibis-washed Spartina marsh, crab-sifted, spawning oyster bank, corded egrets, terns and cormorants, Carolina parakeets, cypresses and gums, and the shad-sunned maple creeks that harbor teem a continent's sad rim. Hark, listen, shroud, and mourn with me within the slow-drift cloud of tupelos, black-lipped to the bullfrog's call, stagnant hillocks of moccasin grass, trillium fern and dying scent, cougar, black bear, bobcat snarl, and ivory bill's stark rasped krill. O mourn with me the rose rise rush of fall line hush and slow drift languid stream that pulls the silvered mountain dew plus past humus a million years in brew, and cycle flows the clear aired rain as it glows within the primal gleam's gulf stream. And look there at a glimpse of freakish clouds upon the blue hazed peaks that harbinger cooling even pour, and question the sunset riding ships waiting beyond the dipping shore. Hush, hush, for thus it begins, wind teller, watcher of the veils. Let the nighttime breezes drop a while, the eyes await amid the trees, as we hold our breath and try foretell whether they bring us happiness of hope, or the sharp poke of dark and spited years to which we alone are uninvited. As the east's fresh rays refill the sails, and hushness dews upon the rails amid a mist of mourned expectancy, and rush of offshore breeze that drifts the scent of opportunity and fears of nameless gifts, for one cries of witches, ghosts, lost spirits come to haunt the masts and cast their sun-dew-risen hopes into the mire of past oblivion. Another quilts a silent sail, while one more dour hums hymns of native Sussex downs. There is an anxious quietness here, as lonely seagulls mule their names. Susan Constant, Godspeed, and Discovery, to the creaking strains of lanyard pulls, reefs flapping on the crossing blow, a sailor's shout, another's taut reply, orders to heave to, drop swift anchor, ready the shallop, dip its intent oars, and grimly arm themselves against this rim of golden continent. For we come this 14th day of May, with arms not opened but closed stiff tight upon pikes and swords and musket bars, intent on fortress building and stern fight. We come not as freedmen buoyant upon a tide of swift democracy, but as fortune-grubbing gentlemen, plus valets bonded unto us in such ready-maked hierarchy of class and tightly leashed desire that replicates our English serf and sire. We come to learn, but only to survive, and deceive with promises, not respect, to better plunder, toil, and neglect this verdant splendor trophy. We come to construct a fortress to our fears, and deceive the trinket-musing Indians with copper, beads, and colored cloth into surrendering us their common worth. We come, we say, for God, to convert this Satan-rattled land from darkness to the glory light of his stark hand. But 'tis mere excuse of our nature that stealths our short-breathed selves to win for us alone such wealth as can open quarry a ready-taken continent with hopes of imposed feudal dreams, advanced through societal esteem, gentlemen sharing barely aught, intent each on each in each for each, within the bound of soliloquy thought, untitled influence and unjust connections that grant them all prestigious land, and hands us poorer servant men from most intent beginning, a song to sing our menial need and dependence on our master's greed. Indeed, we have left as much as come, pushed as much as fortune pulled, quitted an isle of landless lack where abusive energies hard worked back, plague and overcrowding dysentery linger in bubonic sanctity, here to build divided destinies and satiate a desperate need for gold and passage spite upon occupants unready to concede. Okay, that's thank you. Thank you. So that's a precis of the opening sort of book, the opening section. And the book you'll find is, as I explained, it's taken me 3.5 years to write it. And the reason I wrote it was because I've written history books before, but I've been interested in community, individual values, what it is that makes people tick, what it is that makes history in terms of how people live their daily lives. And so that's why I wanted to write a history that was free from a lot of the kind of tight discipline that you need when you normally write in history books. I wanted to be able to have the freedom to explore human beliefs, cultures, superstitions, songs, dancing, all these different aspects, their craft. That's what this poetry is about. It's about human beings living their lives in a daily way. And it's about their daily conflicts. So we're not talking so much about governors and laws, although they're mentioned. They're mentioned in it. But it's very much from the point of view of everyday people. So even when we see Jefferson, we see him through the eyes of Sally Hemings. When we see George Mason dictating the Bill of Rights, we see him through the eyes of a slave that's tending his roses as he's walking through his garden. He has had a beautiful garden. I don't know if you've ever been to George Mason's place, but my word. That's the angle. That's why I wrote it. And the poetry enables me to have the passion, the feelings, enables me to have intellectual debates. There's a lot of debating that goes on around ideas in the books. There's a lot of songs, hymns, all this sort of thing. Okay. Something else that I've put in and I need to let you know about is that there are... Community is very important in the poetry, and also the ancestors. Our history in terms of what our ancestors, what we can learn from the past, and what our ancestors teach us. And so there are like some mythological beings, if you like, some kind of semi-spiritual beings called that are really our ancestors, and I called them the callings, because we call to them, and they call to us, and they call to us about what we've lost in the past. And they are, in many ways, holding on to what we've lost, hoping that one day we can recover what we've lost, return to what we've lost, and recreate the sort of society, maybe, that we had at one time. So there's the callings, and the callings that are divided into various groups, the music men, the mind weavers, the enchanters, the sufferers, okay? So let me read you another. This now is from book 9, the last book. So we're coming right to the far end. That's the bottom. It starts at the bottom of page 565 and is set in the 1980s. There'll be a little bit of jumping here. I've cut a few little bits out. Okay. And you'll see the same themes in this poem 400 years later as were in that first poem. Okay, as the circle comes full round. And one word, a kokaros is an Indian word for a council, a circle, a council circle. Okay, so sitting in kokaros meant they would be sitting in council. I stare high at the cloud-bearded sky, dream drifting o'er our land, as a late spring mist rapid rings the hickories, chestnut oaks, and tulip trees. And a bluebird sings the sun's soft setting as she asks, is that whom we're meant to be? singing our soft soliloquy to the mystery of this ringing land of ours? Then I ask, is this a gleaming dawn or yet another sunset upon the history of our dreams? I raise Upawak to the rising sun, and my soft soul begins to stir in the wisping furls of summer swirls and calls the energies of east and south, west and north, the sky above and the ground beneath my feet to thank the earth for all her care. Are we truly the seeds of the new, fed by a world's awareness of our human destiny and eternal unity within the crying earth? This I ask as I sing, turn, questing of the trees, blessed be the breeze that wafts between my leaves, and songs start ablaze to brew some tea, a plastic bag of chili, open rip a power bar, apply new band-aids, Vaseline, thick socks, battered boots, tidy, say goodbye and wave to later rising guests striding the Appalachian way. Oh, I sing and I sing and I sing, ringing out the names of the generations and the centuries, as I hike with rousing steps the slopes of Lost Mountain, White Top, Buzzard Rock, heels well-weathered, soles bending to the rock, backpack lighter now, 3 weeks peeling in, as I clamber, slide and clamber from ridge to gap to ridge, of Pine and Rogers' highest peaks, ascending from the Cauldron Vales to the zenith of Virginia's range, the land reclaimed by oak and cedar, ash and maple, tulip tree and hickory, where I can comb among the deer and bear, watch the fox and possum stare, and Windteller can smile at last with the resurrection of the sun upon the vibrant forest canopy and feel the rising spark within the drying boughs about his head that sped a surge rebud display upon the greenery of his thought as he spirals joyous between the clouds of drifting drapery. And I sing of Windteller, horseman, of my ancestral soul as it wanders the history of this rolling land. I sing, I sing, I sing from the Tennessee Valley Divide, ringing through Little Wolf Creek, Lick Skillet Hollow, Big Horse Gap, Sugar Run and Sinking Creek to Catawba's high peak side, where Indians roamed and died, and yet is home to dogwood tracts, red clustered berries in the fall, buzzard soaring ridges, thermal deemed, dawn dead azaleas, flaming flared, and amethyst balls of violet petals set upon a swathe of green that climbs the rock-leafed rhododendrons under oak and pine and leading fir. And of what do I sing? Why, I sing of those dogwood bracts, azaleas, buzzards, hawks and crows, hickories, pines and oaks, roots and stones and narrowed rocks. I sing of the corn snake, red and tan and grey, who uncoils upon a sunbeat rock, then quickly slips away. I sing of friends lost upon the loss of day. And I chant the chant of ancient times, of the ancestors of these paths, their stories and their memories carved in every step upon the calling earth, until at last I skelter reach another wooden shelter, a spring to wash and water boil, campers laughing, blister tending, hanging soiled socks and underwear across soft maple branches, there to dry and mend, coaling franks and tins of corn, spreading jelly on weak old rolls, toasted carbon in the flames, then sinking to an evening reed, flashlights held for slipping heads, as we let the night soft nod to ease, at midnight keep our snoring z's. And again I thank the beneficent sun, let him rest a while, the moon well roused her face, welcoming my safe domain and my nightly prayer of thanks. In the morn, once more I call the energies of all come in, join our journey to meaning in our lives, the bliss, the inner joy that comes from opening out to all in care and love and empathy. And I sing the chanting of the names across our highland meadows, draped in sun of black-eyed Susans, ox-eyed daisies, chicory, soapwort, Queen Anne's lace, sorrel, late-graced buttercups, dandelions and inspired mullion, fritillaries and wiry swallowtails, sulphurs, blues, coppers, whites, monarchs on migration routes, flycatchers clinging to the grass, swifts clip darting sparse and close. And I sing those meadowed vales, sing the dales and the words, sing the souls of the butterflies, sing the flowers and the birds. As a harrier hovers in the stillness, sudden plunging, veering, flapping, and flies low across the fields that drape this range of virgin west, from blaze to white-trimmed blaze, across this crest of continent, singing as she goes. Is that me? Am I the harrier or the butterfly, the question or the mystery? Oh, sing with me forever, sing with me forever. Join with us in prophecy of our future's verdant majesty. Thank you. Okay, this next one, this is quite a change of tone. This is from book 5, page 314. See, set in the 1840s. And typical of much of this poetry, it's several poems that weave into one. And so it starts with, in the 1840s and even earlier, the kind of Virginians had an idea that, God, there's a lot of slaves around. We're going to get outnumbered here. And then there's all these free blacks, you know, free African Americans, and they're kind of getting a bit uppity, you know, even under slavery. Let's see if we can get rid of some of them, okay? Jefferson had the idea of shifting them out the other side of the Mississippi. Madison and various others had the idea of moving them back to Africa. And they set up these organizations to ship them back. Now, the problem is that if you're a slave owner and you've got half a dozen slaves, you're not too keen on someone coming along and taking your slave and shipping him back, you know? So really, the only ones they could ship back were the freed slaves. And of course, the freedmen, they were not that happy. You know, they had their trades. They knew nothing of Africa. You know, they were fourth, fifth, sixth generation. You know, they spoke English, didn't speak African language, you know. So there was a lot of problems. And Madison was one of the prime movers behind this move to get the return Africans to Africa. I hammer swift and muscle steady down and down and down and down, drown the hoe within the trough, then throw it back into the coals, heave the bellows down and up, spit upon the black dust floor, and am about to hammer more when three men sudden swift appear at my devil-darkened door, demand my exit, show vague remit, then tackle chain me manumitted into the rear of some dung cart, and dance me shackled under hay to a warehouse entrance, some Norfolk Bayside shanty, and that night shut me, 100 more, next butts of whiskey and molasses, to toss on bitter Atlantic waves in some reverse of ancient trade, then row us to a malarial grave, Sherbro, off a Liberia's coast, toasted, I learn, by wealthy holders of societies that intend to cleanse Virginia's seditious knaves and more deeply sheepish pen their weeping plantation slaves. Dance to live the life planned. Standing ready, partner watching, Mr. Jack Kent opposite me, a fine man, but without a cent, though that glint will get him far. So fiddler ready, and off we spar. Honor your partner forward and back. Honor your partner forward and back. Now swing your partner's right elbow, two-hand swing, and around you go. He's a pleasant dancer, light of step, yet a strong and forceful, charming man. Not like Tobias, the colonel's son, who though rich is really drab, a hopeless specimen, all fits and flab, yet those acres and slaves do allure. Two-hand swing and around you go. Now swing your partner's left elbow. Two-hand swing and around you go. Once around with a do-si-do. Two-hand swing and around you go. Then there's cousin Franklin, but he's too close. And our families have intermarried 5 times yet, so he won't do. Oops, here, we're off. Don't slow. Head couple reel down the track. Meet in the middle and sashay back. Heads cast off and down you go. Now Jonathan Stewart, he has wealth. Father a magistrate, Burgess too. Promised 10,000 acres on his marriage, eldest son of the estate, but too underage for me. I need a man I can respect and will keep me tight upon a righteous household rein. Now raise that arch and raise it high, others duck and away you fly. Raise that arch and raise it high, others duck and away you fly. Sidestep down and take your place, newest couple heads a race. My word, tiring. Exhilarating, swirling, and so real to feel those fine arms and strong bodies pressed to mine. Now comes Richard Brierly with his betrothed, but I still hope he looks at me. Lawyer son of parson, planter too, but really 300 acres will not do. And off again. Honor your partner forward and back. Honor your partner forward and back. Now swing your partner's right elbow, two-hand swing, and around you go. Now swing your partner's left elbow, two-hand swing, and around you go. Once around with a do-si-do, two-hand swing, and around you go. Though Brierly's a militia ensign now, parish officer, and they say will soon replace old Stewart as the new Burgess. So maybe he is a prospective catch. While two-hand swing and down we skip, as yours and mine do jointly trip, the caller heeding us as around we go in incestuous steps of do-si-do that breed within our blue blood halls, while fields of pale white skin enthral and distinguished Gentile pallid skin from our low-bred, well-tanned planter kin. Two-hand swing and around we go. Now raise that arch and raise it high, others duck and away you fly. Raise that arch and raise it high, others duck and away you fly. Sidestep down and take your place, newest couples head the race. Dancing on the bones, within the swings and turns of all direction lost. Okay. It kind of shows how I try to merge in some dance rhythms and songs. Now this one is from is book 5, page 279, and is 1801. Okay. I tripped the stairs. So this is in the same book, and the same book which is about dancing. Okay. And this is near the beginning. So the whole theme, the two main themes, the main imagery in this book is dancing on the bones. That there's a whole class of people that are dancing, and there's a whole other class of people that are being buried under these ballrooms. I trip the stairs to polished boards, all in my dancing finery, and am greeted by my caller's words, hooded, masked, announced, pronounced within the gentle scuff of a falling dancer's ruff, as I tap with foot the blinded trap of oaken door, expectant crowd, that rims the gathered stage about and hangs upon the caller's prayer, as I sudden feel the virgin reel and skip the convulsating trip of the hushed and collared dance, and memories flash askance my mind of Jefferson's disabled promise and Monroe's confined reprieve. Twist and turn, I twist and turn to spin within the startled stare called surprise, and the raven knocking in the gloom as I blaze the pluming charcoal stench of shoe and wire and brazier, the clang and ting and burgeoning of scythes to pikes and swords waiting for our justice time. O Solomon, twist and turn, twist and turn, kick and kick and kick, 27 dancers, eternal hate in angered state, 27, 27, the caller's trace, turning, turning, dancing, forger of my race. Eyes blinded from the fleeing dawn, I was not graced to see. Turning, 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 dancing to the threads life has handed me. And even on that seasoned dawn, upon the graves of nameless slaves, a new plantation house is raised. Hall erected, ballroom stairs, cornice, frieze, and architrave. Their bones rescattered, reinterred beneath its fine-set ashlard walls, where dance the grey-eyed wedding veils that march the tune of vivid death and mock the bones of church and man to moan the breath of auld lang syne. Oh, we'll take a cup of kindness yet. As yet we quilt of ailing parables, sew the seams of Jonah and the whale, patch a work of frieze of Jacob's ladder, the northern stars and Pleiades, then guide the stitch of path and ride, fence line, mount and town, and hang them on the railings for the secret shadowed farer's gown to pass and frown and understand. Thank you. So this poem that is actually about, the beginning is actually about Gabriel's rebellion. He was hanged, okay? He and 26 others were hanged, his brother Solomon and him. They decided they were going to march on Richmond and wave the white flag of freedom. It wasn't surrender in those days, it meant freedom. And Governor Monroe would free all the slaves once they presented their petition. So very naive, but glorious in some ways. A huge storm came that night. It must have been a hurricane or something, a thunderous downpour. The bridges were washed away, the streams were flooded, the conspirators were forced to flee. Some kind of turned the others in, hoping for some sort of to be spared from being hanged, but 27 of them were hanged. Then it moves on this little bit to right at the end about quilting, and a quilt where Jonah and the whale and the stars, especially the northern stars, would put on these quilts that... That slave women would make these quilts that would help on the Underground Railroad, that would give signs. And they would hang them. There were all sorts of various signs they would put out to say this was a safe house, or you could sleep in this barn, or there would be maybe food available, or don't stay here, you know, whatever. And one of them was to put a quilt out on the fence. If a quilt was put out, that usually meant that it was safe. Or it would have a message on it, telling the slaves where to go. And this was quite a common thing that happened. So slaves would follow these lines of quilts, and they would, as I say, they would, the so-called patterns would actually be paths. And also, I think it's interesting that the Brer Rabbit tales, and Brer Rabbit plays an important part in this poetry. That Brer Rabbit tales were also there to help slaves learn how to survive in the wild. You know, a lot of the tricks Brer Rabbit gets up to are how to basically survive, you know, catch your food, evade the patrollers, you know, build secret hollows, all this sort of thing, okay? So it's very interesting the ways in which the slaves kind of developed a culture of learning how to survive and escape. How are we doing for time? What time is it? Okay, let me have a look. Okay, I'm going to read one, or just one more, and then we'll have a discussion. Okay. This is gone to the 1950s. This is book 8, page 494. And again, the four enchanters are some of these mystical ancestral beings that kind of pervade the story. And they're there for various purposes, to give guidance, to kind of reflect upon aspects of our history in a spiritual kind of way. Okay. So this is from the 1950s. Who am I? Who am I? Who am I? Am I still dreaming? Am I? Am I? And who cares who I am? For America's now atop the world, its hope and its savior. I am the peddler. I am mama, pregnant for the third time. GI husband, home and set. Cheap mortgage, easy debt. Those were the days. Who polishes her electric range, entranced by Perry Como on the radio, as a salesman drops by happenstance, escapes her from her gloomy props, and sells her dusters, brushes, and a broom, as the organ grinder's winding on his solitary tune. I am that salesman, too, selling house to house, toasters, washers, refrigerators, fitted kitchens, mowers, new hopes and desires, as adverts, sales and marketing manufacture dreams, conform us to a new reality defined by jingles, tunes and puffs of smoke from the magician's sleight of hand. I am democracy. I am liberty. I am honeyed Christianity. And I am a dream of money. Lots of it. Yet the price of my dream is the reality that I strive 6 days for another, spend mere one for myself, and have 30 minutes just to spend each tender nightly life with my trusted kids and wife. Tick, tick, tick. Get me out of here! Get me out of here! Oh, cast the bones of present follies to faith's ancestored realm and sing the song of severed praises to the man who names the man I am. For I ask again, who am I? Am I just American? Or also Irish, Swedish, Arabian, white, black, Native American, Italian, Hispanic, Cuban, Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, Baptist, Catholic, Jew? So many races, religions, beliefs, a rainbow of hopes and doubts, lives left behind and uplifted griefs. What does it even mean to be American? Do I look to the whole for my safety, for my comfort and my culture, for my partner and my family? Or do I fear the whole, fear the streets I do not know, neighborhoods to never venture, cultures that do not greet me, some faith I cannot live by nor respect, ideologies that terrify? And what will it take to break me free from the myopia of my individuality and feel at one with every distant chord? Flag and anthem, Lord and country, In God We Trust, White House presidency, or something else closer to the reality of freedom's harsh complexity? Something bearing more than scant veiled testimony to inner city life, the strife of unemployment, racism's relentless droning song, worthless wages, hours long, exhaustion, poverty, or desperate single-parent prophecy that drags us all below the line. Oh, the bones, the bones. The bones echo to the calls of our ancestors' weeping walls and to the four enchanters on their rock beneath the towering gorge of the rushing Roanoke, there to sing the songs of joys and sufferings, and sufferings of the world. Oh, the bones, the bones, the bones. I believe one America will emerge from community and family, a joint merging of responsibility, not individual screams of property, nor the constant stress of work and work, destroying self and spouse and child, plunging to horrendous debt. Oh, there we are. The more we strive and more we get. No, I believe it will arise from sharing, caring, interbeing, and mutual powered dependency. Give us control upon our lives, our work, our cities, and our state. For only when they're our true fate, not the myopic domain of a few. When the weak are well protected, schooling more than prison life, old age more than poverty, skin more than prejudice, potential more than inheritance, and those who do not succeed are cared for as much as those who do, will we have that healing heart to give soul to this great nation and knell the bells of victory in this great historic commonweal. Okay, thank you. Okay, yes, bye Lou, thanks. So yeah, if anyone has any questions or would like to have a discussion, you know, like to talk a bit. Yes. I felt I got into a certain period of time and then would kind of get out of it and get into another period of time. I found the modern stuff the hardest, actually. The modern stuff. It was easy to write about the Native Americans and write, to a certain extent, about slavery. There's a certain distance on it and a certain historical perspective. It was very difficult to kind of get a historical perspective on the 1970s, 80s, 90s. It came once I began to understand the history of segregation and the fact that segregation didn't really end in the South until really about 1970 was really when it went. The history of Virginia constitutions is very interesting. There was a constitution back when Virginia was founded, and then there was one in the 1830s, and then there was one in 1868, just after the Civil War, and then there was a segregationist constitution, I call it, 1901, which really brought in segregation. It kind of brought in the poll tax, it brought in literacy tests for voting. It really was aimed, in fact, they openly say, and it's quoted in the book, the aim was to disenfranchise as many black voters as we possibly could without affecting too much the white vote. So it was a segregationist constitution, 1901. That was only replaced in 1970, 71. So really, when we look at Obama and we look at present tendencies, we really have to look at this. We're really only one generation away from segregation, from poll tax, from the literacy test, when the fact that also a lot of poor white people couldn't vote because to pay the poll tax, if you got behind the poll tax, it would be expensive and these people couldn't afford it. So that kind of began to put it in perspective. Then I realized, okay, you had the kind of segregationist Democrats and then they were kicked out by the Republicans, and then the Republicans are now, Virginia's now kind of changing back to a different type of Democrats. I kind of began to get a hold on what our history has been the last 30 or 40 years. But it's like, it's kind of a bit kind of, I'm throwing it out there. You know, I'm not really sure how people are going to judge the last. So that was the hardest, I think. Yes, Barbara. I think that was true. Under slavery, there was far less segregation. I mean, blacks and whites would go to the same churches. The blacks would be upstairs in the gallery, but it would be the same church. Blacks and whites would live together. In Richmond, it was a really integrated community because the black servants had to live next to the white homeowners. Oh, there were. Okay. Just made it up. Well, you know, I started because I actually wanted to get the historical framework in place first. Before I really wrote much poetry, I started with the historical framework. So I read just about all the major histories of Virginia. But I didn't want to get real. Well, the major history, like Dabney's history, I mean, one of the problems is Dabney finishes in 1970. So again, there's 35, 40 years that he doesn't cover. But also Dabney takes it the traditional way. He's looking at governors. He's looking at, economic factors, this sort of thing, wars and battles, and this sort of, which is valuable. And he's very good for his dates. But I really then had to delve deeper and go to original sources to find, okay, well, how would a bateau man actually pole his boat down the James? I mean, what language would he use? And what would his cargo have been carrying? How would a coal miner have actually been digging coal in the first Richmond? The very first coal field in America was in around Richmond. It's a Richmond coal field. And you can still see. And that's why so many parts around Richmond are named after Scotland or parts of England where they're coal mining. Chesterfield, Midlothian, Dumfries. These are all coal mining areas in England. And Wales, and the Welsh and Scots miners came over, and mixing with slave miners, there were miners from Britain coming over, and also there were a lot of slaves that were miners, and they started digging this coal field. It goes under the James River. It's very steep, and it gets very wet because the James River's right above it. So But then I had to research that, and that's not in Dabney, and that's not. So how do you find out about this? Well, you go to websites and little historical sites and build up this picture of a very different history than is presented in something like Dabney. So it's a matter of just doing this, of just trying to find original sources and focusing on crafts and people who were actually like a woman churning butter in 1740. Well, how did they churn butter in 1740? Did they have a rotary one? No, they had one that goes up and down. And so all this sort of thing, you know? So, yeah, it was difficult. That was the hardest part. Well, I want you to discover that for yourself, okay? And plus, I raise a lot of these things, but I'm not there to answer them, okay? I didn't want the book to be answering. I wanted the book to be raising questions and saying, well, yeah, maybe there is something we have lost. And if you read book one, I think you will see some of the things we have lost. For example, there's a whole long poem about, it's actually in book two, a long poem about a backwoodsman. He's a beaver hunter. There's a group of them, and they go in dugout canoes, and they go. It's a long poem, and it takes us up the Chesapeake, up the Potomac, into the Shenandoah, and back down the James. He does this big circle. So that's kind of symbolic in a way, the circle. But what he discovers on that route, on that journey, I think in many ways are things that we have lost. But that's up to you to try and work out and to try and think, well, what is it we have lost? And what have we gained? I mean, there are many things we've gained as well. I haven't visited that quilt museum. There's some quilts in Richmond, on display in Richmond, that I have seen. And so I have seen some of the quilts where they have the stars on, and this was actually based on a quilt that I'd seen with the Pleiades and the North Pole and various paths and rivers, and then things like bear paws, and they're various symbols that they use, animal symbols that they used for directions. No, but quilting is a major theme of the book. We follow quilting all the way through, right up till the present day, and the symbol of quilting, of kind of bringing patchwork together, it's a very powerful symbol for me of who we are as a nation, really. Oh, my gosh. Do you know, okay, I started off thinking about that, and that's where the title came from. Partly the title came from that. The title also partly came from the 300th anniversary of Virginia. The celebration was called the Virginiad. They had, I think Eisenhower was there, and they had the fleet going by and all that. So that was, in a way, where I got the idea for the title. But the thing about the Iliad is the Iliad is about one person, really, one man. The Odyssey as well. The Iliad is really about Achilles. It's about Achilles' anger, okay? And how Achilles gets all upset, you know, his brother is slighted, he doesn't get the treasure that he wants, you know, he goes out and he gets... you know, he takes out an old Hector and the rest of them. And then the Odyssey is Odysseus, he goes off, he's a leader of men. He kind of goes and does all this stuff. And he comes back and he kills all the suitors of his wife and all that stuff. I wanted this to be very much a people's history. Okay, so in a way, it was, in the sense that I wanted it to be a story and have a plot. And there is like a plot through this. There are themes and there are characters and there are things that happen. But again, I rejected that form because I wanted it to be a people's history. And that's why right at the beginning I say, right in the preface, this is not an epic of one hero, but of countless borrowed spirits who have roamed our woods and rivers unacknowledged, without trace, etc. Okay. So that's the conscious me saying, no, this is not like the Iliad. This is a people's history. And maybe saying that that we've grown up maybe as a nation in a sense that we can move beyond individuality, beyond the sort of thing that's got us into this huge, horrendous mess we're in right now, and maybe say, you know, we need responsibility, we need community, we need some other values here. So that's what this is raising, the questions it's raising and asking. That's a good point. The one of the poems about Washington is from the point of view of a one of his soldiers at Valley Forge. So, and watching Washington, the Hessian soldiers know. The Hessians are mentioned indirectly, and the fact that a number of the Hessians and also the British soldiers did settle here is mentioned. One thing is that there were a lot of northern teachers that came down after the Civil War. There was this whole movement to try and educate the slaves, the ex-slaves. And so there's a poem about a Yankee teacher who comes down and sets up a little school in some county somewhere, some remote place, and is starting to teach them how to read, how to count, the national anthem, you know, that America was founded on democracy and freedom and the Constitution. She comes down to teach the slaves because they'd never heard about this. Well, let's have a 10-minute break and get some more food, and then I'll let my voice rest a little while, and then I'll read another poem or two and just to close everything up.